control, she told Chayda over and over again. Always control. But Zaid was hardly in control. She had pushed herself well past her limits. Onur dropped to one knee and snapped the head of his spear towards Zaid's face. Zaid merely slipped below it, a move as easy as a cattail bowing in the wind. And then she drove in and delivered three sharp strikes, two to his neck and one to his eyes. Onur reeled, releasing a bellow of pain as he dropped his spear and grabbed his face. Zaid didn't stop. She struck his kidneys, then the joint above his hips, and then she took up his spear. Onur was defenseless. But Zaid could go no farther than lifting the great weapon. She pressed the butt into the ground at her feet, one hand gripping it with knuckles white as snow as she fought for breath. Her other hand was pressed to her heart. She willed herself past the pain, forced her body to listen. After two more deep breaths, she lifted the spear. For my mother! In trying to deliver that fatal blow, however, she missed. Onur shifted on the sand, battered the spearhead aside so that it struck only his armor, not his exposed neck. She tried again, and Onur did the same. Chayda wasn't sure how he had recovered so quickly until she saw how dark his skin was becoming. No, not his skin. Black hair was sprouting along his forearms, his neck, his face. His arms and legs were distending, bending strangely at the wrists and elbows and shoulders and hips. His body was elongating. A roar of pain erupted from his throat as he clawed for Zaid, and she stepped back, wheezing. She lifted the spear above her head, gripped it with both hands, and ran toward him. Another roar came from Onur, but this time it sounded nothing like a human, but a great cat. Indeed, the transformation that had been whispered of, his gift from the gods, was occurring before their very eyes. He'd taken the form of a massive panther with black silken fur that glittered beneath the sun, larger than any cat Chayda had ever seen. Even the great Kunduni lions that were paraded through Sharakai's streets from time to time. The panther tore its way free of Onur's armor. Teeth bared, it bounded away as Zaid thrust the spear at its chest. However much Zaid's two-fingered strikes had slowed Onur's movements before, the paralysis had vanished after the change, and Zaid was much, much slower than before. Chayda fought harder, as did Sumeya and Melis. Those who stood before them tried to slow them down, but they had fear in their eyes and gave ground before the whirring ebon blades. Chayda had only just reached open space, the way now clear to Zaid and the transformed Onur, when the panther reared back from one last weak thrust of the spear and lunged for Zaid's throat. Faster than Chayda's eye could follow, the panther's jaws clamped down. Chayda came rushing toward it, screaming, hoping the panther would turn to face her. But the panther only jerked its head back and to one side. A tearing sound came with it. Blood spurted high from the red, bloody, gaping hole where Zaid's throat had once been. It spattered against her white matron's dress as the panther dove back in and bit into her shoulder. It tore more of Zaid's flesh away, and then at last seemed to recognize the threat Chayda represented. No. It had been waiting, hoping to catch her off guard, she realized. It turned and swiped for her, ducking in one sinewy movement as she swung River's daughter across her guard. The panther's paw caught her leg with one reaching swipe and sent her to the ground, but Chayda was ready. She chopped down as she fell, catching the panther just above the claw. It was on her in a moment, jaws wide in hopes of ripping out her neck as well. Chayda's only hope was to hold River's daughter like a bar of steel. She shoved it hard into the panther's gaping maw. It cut deep, caught in the panther's teeth. Even so, the beast used its sheer weight to press down on her and tried to bite her face or neck. She could smell its fetid breath as a foaming mixture of spittle and blood dripped from its blood-stained teeth. As its massive claws tore into her ribs and stomach, Cheda worked the blade back and forth. It chipped teeth, cut into the panther's cheeks, but the beast seemed oblivious to it. But then it jerked its great head up and roared while twisting its body to face Sumeya. Sumeya slashed her ebon blade, but the panther was too quick. It reared and leapt, twisting its body in the air as it did so, and using its great paw to club Sumeya across the head. She stumbled and fell to the sand, her shamshir flying through the air like a wounded crow. The panther would have had her had Melisse not been there. She cut once, slicing the beast's shoulder, then again across its face. The panther tried to charge, to use its mass against her, but Melisse was not new to the blade. She stumbled back, dodged to one side and rolled backward, to come up with her sword at the ready. Cheda kicked herself to a stand and rushed to her aid. "Anor!" she screamed, hoping to distract him before he ripped out Melisse's throat. The panther was bleeding from several deep wounds along its ribs, forelegs, and head. None of the wounds seemed mortal, however. Honor's great spear was just before her. As Honor rushed Melisse, Cheda picked it up and hefted it over her right shoulder. Her right hand burning hot, she stepped forward and launched it as Melisse was felled by a swipe of the panther's bloody claw. The spear sank deep into the panther's ribs. It howled in pain as it rolled away. Sand caked the panther's coat, where its fur was matted with blood. Cheda sprinted forward, hoping to end it, but before she had taken two strides, the panther somehow managed to regain its feet and bound away. In moments, it was gone, lost behind a line of black spear warriors. Suddenly, the roar of the battle returned. The fight had reached a fever pitch. Honor's warriors, who had held back on Honor's command, now charged in. Cheda wanted to go after Honor to stop him, but he was heading for a ship that could sail away at his command. She was swept back into the battle. Horns blew, the black spears were sounding the retreat. More of their forces began to pull back and their ships began peeling away. The Kianat and Kadri soldiers had been hard-pressed before Anur's retreat. Some were heartened now, hoping to grind the black spear soldiers into the desert. But others, including Masid, were calling for a halt. Hundreds of Kadri warriors were gathered around the ship the worm was attacking. They launched arrows at the sinewy beast and threw spears. Some who were brave or unfortunate enough to stand before it tried to pierce its scintillant skin with their swords. All to no avail. It was impervious to all but the strongest blows. Only in a few places was there blood of any kind. The worm had already destroyed three ships and was now leaping onto another as the Kianat and Kadri forces began to disengage. Many were focused on fighting the worm, but as many or more were helping the old, the young, or the wounded to flee from it. Amidst all this madness, an old woman appeared. It was Leora, holding a staff in both hands crosswise against her body. She looked both powerful and fey as she strode forward, like one of the first women. Any who saw her felt it as well. They stepped aside, clearing a path between her and the worm. Perhaps sensing her power, the worm halted its attack and swiveled its great head toward her. In a burst of movement, it leapt from the deck of the dhow to the gold sand below. The black spear soldiers were retreating. They were turning their ships and sailing away, taking the wounded Honor with them. But Cheda paid them little mind. Her mouth agape, she walked toward Leora, transfixed by the scene playing out before her. With only open sand before it, the worm slithered forward. It looked like a serpent with thorns upon its head and bright luminous skin. It took one lithe movement, then another, each bringing it closer to Leora, who had stopped 20 paces away. The worm's approach seemed more ritual than natural. Leora seemed calm and expectant, and in complete control, as if she and the worm had entered into an arcane rite, the outcome of which had already been decided. Like a songbird, wary of danger, the worm approached. It would twist, stop, then slither forward again. It looked as if it were describing ancient sigils. Leora's staff was moving in that same strange way. The two of them were linked in that moment, beast and desert witch. In that moment, the sun struck the gemstones on the staff's bulbous head, making them glint like a distant oasis. Breath of the desert. Cheda had seen that staff before, though at the time it had been held by the hand of a goddess. It was Nalame's staff, the very one Cheda had used to strike the acacia in her garden. When the worm came within several paces of Leora, it lowered its great head, dwarfing Leora's bent, aged form. Its opaline eyes studied her, while the movements of its head mimicked the rhythms of her staff. Then, in a movement that reminded Cheda of a crane preparing to take flight, Leora spread her arms wide, tipped her head back, and opened herself to the sky. The worm erupted into the air. Its long wings flapped once, twice, thrice, each movement a wave that continued, rope-like along its entire serpentine length. In lazy circles it lifted, its passage describing a winding column above the battle as its form slowly diminished. As if its departure were weighing on her soul, Leora staggered, then collapsed, unceremoniously, to the sand. In that same moment, the worm dipped, then streaked eastward, trailing after the Black Spear ships. Chapter 56.
They're beginning to fan out, my lord!
Ramad stirred momentarily from his slumber, but had soon slipped back into the land of dreams. He was naked, his body bruised and beaten. Meriem stood over him in a gown made of blood-red silk. The fabric cascaded over her frame to fall across his body, and where it touched, pain followed. He tried to fight it, tried to move, but fighting only seemed to make the pain and his imprisonment worse. Her eyes brimming with malice, Meriem lowered herself until she straddled his hips.
"You think you can stop me?"
She smiled and hooked his shirt with one finger. With a single violent motion, she ripped it down the center, then pressed her thumbnail to his chest, like a hunter preparing to split firewood. Her hair fell across his cheeks as she leaned down and whispered into his ear.
"After everything we've been through, everything you've learned of me, you thought I would throw it all away for you."
She drove her thumbnail deeper in his chest, piercing skin. Her eyes, meanwhile, her eyes were changing, the pupils elongating, becoming more taurine. The irises brightened to a burnished gold, while her skin turned black as night.
"Your father would be ashamed,"
he managed to say through his haggard breaths.
"My father was a coward. And what am I?"
Her strange eyes blinked, as if she was surprised he would even ask the question.
"A besotted fool. I do love you," You see?
She leaned close and kissed him. Her lips were inhumanly warm.
A greater fool the world has never seen.
She pressed her thumbnail deeper into his flesh, and he was helpless to prevent it. It slipped between his ribs until he could feel her nail with every beat of his heart.
My lord, the king's ships are spreading out.
Ramad lurched awake. He had been sleeping against the bulwarks of his yacht, the Blue Heron. They were sailing under a stiff breeze far to the east of Sharakai.
When?
He managed after a moment.
A few minutes ago.
Chichio called from the top of the mainmast.
Best we slow, until we see what they're about.
Ramad sat up and put the heels of his hands to his eyes, hoping to clear the nightmarish images of Miriam from his mind.
Do it! Aye!
Chichio called. Chichio's curly hair was caught by the wind as he slipped down along the yacht's lone mast. He and Rago set about the business of reefing the sails, while Tiron manned the wheel and guided the ship over the softly rolling dunes. Sleep weighed on Ramad like a millstone, but he drew himself up and breathed deeply, absently rubbing the place where Dream Meriem had pierced his skin. The horizon wavered ahead, the heat of the desert distorting all, but he could see the hint of masts and sails. It was difficult to see how many there were, but it was clear the fleet was spreading out. Amidships, Brahma was leaning over the gunwales, retching. He was no sandsman, that much had been clear from the outset, but there was more to it than sand sickness. Rumayesh's presence in the fleet they were chasing, and her imprisonment at Meriem's hands, was doing much to worsen his malaise. After Ramad and Brahma had left the House of Kings, they'd gone to Chichio and Rago's favourite haunts. Tiron, with a bit of good fortune, had been there as well. They debated for a time what to do, where to go, but there was really no debate for Ramad. He needed to find Cheda. He needed to warn her, tell her everything that had happened, as well as what Meriem now planned. They had found the Blue Heron guarded, but with no more than the usual pair of guardsmen. It had taken little for Chichio and Vrago to subdue them, after which they had bound and gagged their countrymen and left them beneath the docks, then sailed by night along the arms of the great southern harbour's entrance and out to open sand. They had sailed east for days before stumbling across a fleet of the king's ships, the one that lay before them still, but they hadn't quite known the scale of it until now. The ships spread farther and farther apart, more and more of them becoming clear along the horizon. Ramad counted at least 50 ships, and there were probably more beyond the horizon. It looked like one of the mighty caravans of old.
Bloody gods, Brahma said, staring at it from the gunwales. They're not taking this lightly, are they?
The kings, Chichio said in Sharakan.
They no taking no more shit from the tribes.
One tribe, Ramad corrected. They want to destroy the 13th tribe before the truth spreads.
What truth?
Chichio asked. Ramad stared at him. Chichio was not the sharpest sword on the battlefield, but Ramad had told him all of this already.
That 13th tribe once sailed the desert along with the other 12. That they were sacrificed and nearly destroyed on Bet Iman.
The sun slanted across Brahma's scarred face as he shaded his eyes.
The gem is there.
He flicked his hand toward the center of the line of ships.
Somewhere.
Holding one hand over his gut, he slumped onto the deck and leaned hard against the bulwark.
It's getting worse, Ramad asked.
It's as bad as it has ever been.
It meant that Meriem had the doors to the amulet open. Brahma could feel it when she did. He could feel Rumayesh's emotions as well.
The link between them saw to that, and ensured that Brahma would either fight to save her or suffer for his inaction.
Can you tell what she's doing?
No, she's too far away.
Ahead, it was becoming clear the ships were forming a curving line, creating a cordon, perhaps, or trying to hem something in. Meriem had promised King Kiral she would use Chaedah's blood to summon Guldrathan when they were near enough. When the Arrek came near, the logic went. It would sense Hamzakir, whom she and the king both suspected would be on hand to help Onor. Had the time come? Had they found Onor's fleet? Brahma seemed to have picked up on the same thing.
Now we come to it, he said.
Have you thought about what I said?
Rama nodded.
We need to warn Chaedah.
You don't even know where she is.
I don't know. But Meriem does.
He waved to the line of ships.
If they're preparing their trap, it means that Chaedah and Hamzakir are near, which means that we could warn her.
Rama made a face.
Well, of course, my lord. And I'm sure the kings themselves would sprinkle rose petals to mark the heron's path.
I didn't say we'd sail in.
Brahma stared across the desert.
What of the other option we discussed?
We can't go after Meriem now. She's too well guarded.
Perhaps. Perhaps not. Either way, what good will it do to risk the king's cordon, just to inform Chaedah she's about to be murdered by one of Goshen's children?
She deserves to know.
Not your kid talking. She can do nothing to stop Guldrathan. We, on the other hand, can.
That's your hunger for Rumayesh talking.
A smile tugged at one corner of Brahma's scar-torn lips.
That doesn't make it less true.
Ahead, the navy ships seemed to have stopped altogether, yet their sails were still set.
Strange, Brahma said.
An eerie chill came over Ramad as he watched the king's fleet just sitting there.
Stop the ship.
Aye,
came Tiron's reply. Vraga and Chichio were just beginning to pull in the sails when the wind began to die. One moment it had been strong, if blustering. Then it was a breeze, hardly strong enough to power a ship. And finally it deadened, and the sound died with it. The desert was utterly silent. The atmosphere itself was strange and primal, as if something momentous were about to happen.
A sign from the gods, Chichio said,
staring warily at the sky. Ramad didn't disagree. Wind or no wind, perhaps he shouldn't pass up a chance to stop Meriem. As he had for days, he struggled with what it might mean for Chimer. What he was about to do was not only treason, it could very well put his country in great danger.
But what Meriem is doing is worse. Can you guide us to the right ship?
He asked Brahma. Brahma shrugged.
As long as she doesn't close the locket.
Ramad turned to Chichio, Rago, and Tiron.
Tow the ship into a trough. We leave at nightfall.
Chapter 57 Kiral watched as the ships of the Royal Navy slowed and then stopped altogether. The doldrums had fallen over the eastern desert, forcing them to stop earlier than they would have liked, but it was still an impressive sight, and one he hadn't witnessed in 100 years. The full power of Sharrakai's navy deploying across the desert. Like the last time, it was to quell an uprising, but unlike the last time, this was a conflict that had the very real possibility of exploding in the king's faces. A century ago, Zaheb had heard whispers of an alliance that might stand against Sharrakai, if not militarily, then at least economically. 4 tribes had united against the kings, with several more considering. Azad was sent to deliver the kiss of steel to the sheikhs, while Zaheb and Onur had volunteered to lead an assault so that those who succeeded the sheikhs would think twice before making any such allegiance again. Now Azad was dead, Onur stood on the opposite side of the battle, and the whispers had driven Zaheb mad. Their grand experiment, their alliance of kings, was beginning to unravel at the edges. It wouldn't last much longer, he suspected. Cahil and Sukru still stood by his side. Bashir would follow whomever had the strongest hand. Isan was a different story. He was involved in all of this, the traitor, Chedamin, the loss of the caches of elixirs, Onur fleeing to the desert, and Usam dying on the way to Isan's palace. Kiral had yet to find the evidence, but he would. And it would be the key to securing Husamatin's allegiance. Move too quickly, and Isan might turn Husamatin against him, a thing Kiral could ill afford. Husamatin was formidable on his own, and the Blade Maidens, whether Kiral liked it or not, were loyal to the King of Swords. Kiral couldn't risk losing him, so he would bide his time. He would uncover enough proof to have Isan's head. He might even give Husamatin the honor of taking it himself. And then we will set about the business of pushing back the interlopers. Malasan and Mireya first.
Are you ready?
Came a feminine voice behind him.
And then Chimer.
Kiral turned to find Queen Meriem, gliding across the foredeck toward him. When she arrived at his side, he waved to the scene in the distance, the sight of a waning battle. Dozens of ships were huddled together. More beyond had fled, most likely Onur's.
It seems the Moonless Host have survived the King of Spears' onslaught. I wonder if they could have done so if, as you say, Khamzakir is here, helping Onur.
Khamzakir is but one man, and the Moonless Host are far from powerless.
You still believe he's gone to Onur, then?
I am certain of it.
I need more than your word. I've brought a Kestrel with me. Perhaps I should send her into his camp to find the truth of it.
With Zaheb unable to so much as repeat his own name, Kiral had taken charge of his bloody nine. Husamatin had balked, but he'd used the excuse of this very campaign to warrant it.
You'll hardly need them as you defend the city,
Kiral had told him.
But they may be paramount to our success in the desert.
Send a Kestrel, and you risk Khamzakir becoming skittish. He may flee as he did in Sharakai.
He may very well do that after today's loss.
Which is precisely why we must summon Guldrada now. Don't leave his fate to chance.
He'd known this hour was coming, and yet saying the words, giving her permission, felt as if he had swallowed a hot stone that was now trying to burn its way out of him.
You're certain it will make for Khamzakir?
It already did once. It cannot help but do so again. The rage it has for him is like no other. No matter that it might be tempted by Chaedah. No matter that other forces stand before it, it would find him and consume him.
With your help, we could simply overpower him.
Granted. But at what cost? With Yasirim left to defend Sharakai, how much damage will your fleet take? What will remain as Malasan and Mireya creep ever closer?
We can retreat to Sharakai if need be.
And give up the desert by doing so?
No, they're not so strong as that.
My lord king, we both have spies.
What do they tell you about the strengths of their armies, the size of their fleets? Charakai would stand against any enemy for a time, but how long could the city withstand a siege without a proper fleet?
Kiral said nothing. She was right, he knew. There were already too many risks with this battle. Choose rashly here, and he might sustain enough damage to his fleet that he'd have no chance to stop Mireya or Malasan should they advance quickly. And given that their enemies would have news of this battle soon, they just might. Were the Asurum fully to heal, he'd push on anyway. But from what Husamatina told him, it was risky. The girl, Chedamin, had managed to override the protections Husamatina had placed on the Asurum. Worse, she'd taken an Aesir as her own. If she could do it once, she could do it again.
"I don't blame you for examining this from all angles," Meriem went on. "Wise men take care at momentous times. But I tell you, O King of Kings, your reasoning was sound all along."
She waved an emaciated hand toward the distant battlefield.
"Whomever you choose to fight on the sand, be it Honor or the Moonless Host or both, Khamzak here will escape if we don't summon Guldrathen. He will not remain to defend his newly chosen king. He will flee. And he is the greatest single threat to Charakai."
Kiral wasn't so sure. There were many threats to Charakai, not the least of them Chedamin herself. She was the daughter of Azad's assassin. She was Ishak's own granddaughter, and a direct descendant of Sahid Alaz. He was furious she had managed to fool both Usam and Husamatine and infiltrated the Blade Maidens. How many secrets had she learned? How many souls had she turned to her side? Zaid had either been turned or been with them in the first place. But then there were the Maiden Melisse and the First Warden herself, Sumeya. It was hard to believe Chayda didn't have a hand in their sudden sympathy toward the 13th tribe. She killed Kulishan. She killed Misut. She escaped on the Night of Endless Swords and had now joined her grandfather in leading not merely a rebellion, but the rebirth of the tribe Kiral had given to the gods in sacrifice.
This had to end now, in the desert. Word of the 13th tribe is already spreading, and while none of the sheikhs will acknowledge them openly, they are likely doing so in private. It will not be long before they seriously consider the overtures Ishak has surely made to them, to join him in a bid to crush the kings of Charakai once and for all.
"When do we begin?"
he asked Meriem. Meriem's smile was most pleased.
"Why now, my lord king?"
She motioned toward the ladder leading below decks.
"Though I rather think it would be best in private, don't you?"
They retired to Meriem's cabin. In the darkened, almost stifling space was the queen's servant, Amaryllis. She stood at a set of shelves built into one wall. She was tending to a beaker, which was suspended above an oil lamp, whose flame was pure blue and which burned without a trace of smoke. The faint green liquid bubbling in the beaker was surely the source of the acrid smell lacing the hot, stifling air. There was something else besides. Something that smelled of decay.
"You can douse the flame,"
Meriem said as she moved to the far side of the table occupying the center of the room.
"It needs to cool a while."
She remained standing and motioned to the unoccupied chair across from her, but Kiral was suddenly and inexplicably nervous.
"I have much to attend to.
This won't take long."
Amaryllis broke the tension by raising two small bottles from the shelf.
Would you care for some arak, my lord king? Or brandy? We have some of Chimera's best.
He waved her offer away. Meriem, meanwhile, waited with a smile he could only interpret as a challenge. He had half a mind to call her out on it, but he would not cast himself as a petrified peasant before her comely servant. He sat, and when Meriem followed suit, Amaryllis brought out a wooden case and set it before her queen, sharing a quick, flirtatious smile with Keral as she did so. Meriem lifted the lid to reveal a fist-sized object hidden in gauze, and two ampules, both filled with a red liquid. While the liquid looked too thin to be pure blood, it was surely a tincture derived from it. One surely was Chader's blood, prepared from the very ampule he had delivered to her, but the other...
Why are there two? He asked.
Meriem shrugged.
There's always a chance that one breaks.
I prefer to leave as little to chance as possible.
Amaryllis brought a ceramic plate and the beaker holding the steaming green liquid, set them next to the case, and then stepped aside to let her queen work. As Meriem took up the ampule to Kirel's left and began swirling it absently, Amaryllis watched eagerly.
Too eagerly, thought Keral. Servants should be noticed only when their presence becomes necessary.
With deliberate care, Meriem tipped the tincture of blood into the beaker of green liquid. Her emaciated hands quivered, but she managed to get all of it in without spilling. Then she swirled the combined mixture around until it was a uniform brown.
You might be interested to know that I've been studying the Malasani of late. Their uses for blood.
She took the wrapped object from the case and began unwinding the gauze.
I find their golems intensely interesting and have endeavored to learn more about them. Much remains hidden in mystery, however. They hide their secrets well.
She continued to unwind the gauze to reveal a red clay simulacrum of a man given the crudely formed genitals. Setting the gauze aside, she placed the figure on the ceramic plate, face up, took up the brown mixture and grasped the amulet that hung along her breast.
I've no idea, for example, how they breathe life into their golems. Even with this,
she gripped the amulet tightly.
I can do no such thing.
She poured a thin stream of the brown liquid onto the figure. She took great care to wet every part of it, legs, chest, arms, then head. The clay glistened. It absorbed the liquid like a sponge, Keral saw, swelling as Meriem turned the figure over and poured more onto its back.
They're said to have intelligence of a sort, a will. It's a wondrous achievement. Still, golems are considered at best simplistic, vastly inferior to a soul given life in the womb. And it makes me wonder, have they simply not tried hard enough? Are they not bold enough to grant true life to such creatures? I'll admit I don't know the answer.
She set the liquid down and regarded Keral carefully.
But it's something I hope to investigate further once I sit the throne of Sharakai.
Even before the full meaning of her words washed over him, Keral felt his heart beat faster, louder. She would sit the throne. It was such an outrageous statement. He thought it was said only in jest. But her eyes were all too serious.
You think to take my throne?
He tried to ask, but nothing came from his mouth. He tried again, but his tongue, his lips refused to respond. He felt made of clay, like the figure on the plate. His breath came faster, His heart pounded so hard he could feel it pulse through his fingertips. He felt his scalp prickle as sweat began to form. He tried to stand, but abandoned the effort a moment later as impossible. He tried to move one arm instead.
"Do that," he told himself, "and it would lead to more."
But his arm was little more than flesh around a dead man's bones.
"Draw your knife," he raged. "Draw your knife, and you might yet escape this cabin with your life."
Miriam went on, as if she were unaware that he was waging a silent battle within.
"I have learned some things, however."
She motioned to the wet clay figure.
"How one commands flesh, for example. Even the most willful among us."
Her polite smile broadened.
"Even those protected by the desert gods themselves."
A trickle of sweat crept through his closely shorn hair, slipped down his temple, then his cheek. He struggled as never before. Miraculously, his right arm began to move. It slipped from the armrest, crept along his waist, inching toward the hilt of his ornamented kinshaw. Miriam's eyebrows rose.
"I am impressed, my lord king."
When he managed to slip his hand around the ivory handle, she picked up the clay figure and moved its right arm. Kiral's arm mirrored the movement, returning to the armrest.
"Even after all I've done, steps I was assured would subdue you utterly."
She motioned to his arm.
"You've managed this. Amazing."
When Kiral managed to utter a single word,
"How?"
it came out in a drunkard slur.
"Why, with your own blood, my lord king."
Miriam poured more of the liquid onto the figure. As the clay soaked it up, Kiral felt the severing of his body from his will.
"Taken in the yard of Thash's temple."
"Gods," Kiral realized. "The woman. Amaryllis."
She had been at the temple. She had pressed the skirt of her dress to the wounds he had sustained when the Arek had attacked. She had taken it and delivered it to her queen. He swung his gaze up to Amaryllis, who looked on with a dispassion that made him go cold. His breath now came in terrible, wheezing gasps. When Miriam began stroking the chest of the figure, however, his breathing slowed. For all the calm on the exterior, his terror was soaring to levels he hadn't experienced since the moment he had first seen the might of the gathered tribes 400 years before. In that moment, he'd felt his own death. He felt the same now, a certainty that the brightness of the desert would dim from his eyes. This time the gods would not save him. They had come to him those many years ago, only him, days before Bet-Iman, dangling immortality before his eyes. He'd taken it, vowing to himself, if not the gods, that he would compel the others to go along with him. What was 1 in 13 when all of them might otherwise perish? They'd agreed. They'd given up the haughty Sahid Alaz and his people and gained life for so many. But nothing so momentous as that went unnoticed in the desert. He'd always known that one day the fates would come to collect their due. Here, in the ship, or perhaps when the sun rose, the Lord of all things would come for him. The only question remaining was the manner of his death. That question was answered a moment later. Part of it, in any case, when the cabin door behind him opened and a man stepped into view. A man with a long beard, a long face, and expressive eyes.
"It's done,"
Hamzakir asked.
"It's done,"
Miriam said as she motioned to Kiral.
"Best we move quickly."
"Very well."
Hamzakir turned Kiral's chair so that it faced him and not the table.
"If you please."
Miriam took the head of the clay figure and tipped it back. Corral's body immediately followed suit, and his mouth opened of its own accord. He knew what was about to happen, and still he was startled when something sharp pierced his right wrist, and then dumbfounded when Hamzakir held his own wounded wrist over Corral's open mouth. Blood trickled against his lips and tongue. The bitter copper taste spread down his throat as Hamzakir's beard tickled his wrist. He could see nothing save the wooden beams above him, the decking boards, but he felt Hamzakir's lips as they were pressed to his own wounded wrist. The two of them were exchanging blood. A warmth filled his gut, but his fingers had gone cold. The two feelings warred, the warmth within spreading outward as rivers of cold travelled backward from his fingers, along his wrists, up his arms and across his shoulders. The two sensations were in such direct opposition, he felt as if he were being torn in two. How long this went on, he couldn't say. The moments were strung together by threads of growing horror.
"It's enough, I think,"
Miriam said.
"We must be sure,"
Hamzakir replied, ignoring her implied command.
"It's enough,"
Miriam repeated.
"I'll not risk my life because enough,"
Miriam said. Hamzakir blinked rapidly, as if he were trying to wake himself, then ran a finger over the dripping wound on his wrist. A sizzling sound filled the air. A bit of smoke lifted from his wrist, and the bleeding had stopped. He did the same to Kiral. Other than a small discoloration on his wrist, there was no evidence of the puncture. Not even a trace of blood remained.
"A few more drops will make a difference one way or another, and we have more to do tonight."
His head lowered. Where Hamzakir had been sitting earlier, he saw a different man. One with closely shorn hair, stubble along a strong jaw, pockmarked skin, one small remnant of a childhood disease that had racked his body for months and nearly killed him. Any who looked at him would say, "Here stands Kiral Rananala, the Sun King, the King of Kings, a white tree of tribe Halarijan." It was so complete, even down to the way he squinted when collecting his thoughts, Kiral had to admire it. And he, in turn, must look like Hamzakir.
"What now?"
he tried to ask, but whatever free will he had managed to summon earlier was gone. He was a spectator in this play, nothing more. What followed felt dreamlike. Amaryllis helped Hamzakir to exchange clothes with Kiral. They spoke softly as they worked, but their words somehow slipped past him, strangely muted, as if he had wax in his ears. When it was done, he was commanded to stand and move to the cabin window. As his body complied, he wondered how they had orchestrated it all and what they planned to do next. Hamzakir would take Kiral's place in Eventide, that much was certain. From there, they could ensure that Chimaera became favored in Sharakai. The other kings would remain oblivious to the truth. How long before they stood alone on Turiat? A month? A year? Kiral moved to the window, slipped through it and down to the sand. He walked east as the stars shone above. It came as no surprise that neither moon had risen. Kiral was certain the gods had abandoned him. As he made for the ships in the distance, not a single person from their camp called out to him. Not a single soul barred his way. The sand beneath his boots felt soft, welcoming. It felt right, this walk, proper in the grand scheme of things. He had not thought to return to the desert as anything but a conqueror. But to go like this, alone, felt as if he were going to speak to a dear friend, long forgotten. In that moment, as he studied the stars above the horizon, he understood the second part of their plan. Their plan for him. They must snuff out the legend of Hamza Kir for their grand ruse to succeed. And here he was, dressed in Hamza Kir's clothing and wearing his likeness.
And to think, it was by my hand that so many moves were made in order to see Hamza Kir dead.
For the first time in a long while, he wished Isan was here. The man was a jongleur in king's clothing, a fool in royal livery, and Kiral hated him for it. But he would have appreciated the beauty of this grand joke. Had he the ability to laugh, he most certainly would have, but he didn't. So he trudged on, his possessed steps carrying him ever closer to Onur's camp. Chapter 58. Through the blanket that was draped over him, Brahma studied the comings and goings from the galleon anchored 100 paces distant. He'd left Amansir and his men hours ago, wending his way closer and closer to the king's ships. Only a short while ago, he had seen Queen Meriem standing on the foredeck beside the King of Kings himself. They had gone below decks after a brief talk, to do what exactly, Brahma wasn't sure, but he planned to find out. For the 100th time on his journey from Amansir's yacht, he clutched the bag at his belt and felt the round shape of the obsidian stone within it. The stone he had procured before hiding in the old watchtower near the Chimeri Embassy House. It would be needed to name Rumayesh if he somehow managed to smash the sapphire. He had debated for days on the wisdom of his plan, but he saw no alternative. He had already given in to the urge of trying to free Rumayesh, and there were really only two alternatives for doing so. Somehow steal the gem away, or break the sapphire. The former seemed the simplest route, and perhaps slightly less dangerous, but it would leave the sapphire intact. He'd be beholden to Rumayesh, as he was before, and he'd do everything in his power to see that he didn't fall back into his old life. No, the only way he might see himself freed was to smash the sapphire and release Rumayesh. If Queen Meriem wasn't dead by then, Rumayesh would surely take her revenge against her. But even if Meriem was dead, Brahma hoped that Rumayesh would be grateful and see to it that he be given back what remained of his life to live as he pleased.
Listen to yourself, you bloody coward. A real man would kill himself and leave Rumayesh to whatever fate awaited her.
The thoughts were his own, but they felt like Rumayesh taunting him in that tower those many years ago. He could even hear his own pitiful reply.
I never claimed to be brave.
Beyond the galleon, several fires had been lit. Dozens of silver spears and blade maidens wandered the area, some on sentry duty, others setting their ships to rights, others still tending to the meal. Brahma's mouth watered at the smell of roast lamb as the heat of late afternoon finally gave way to night.
And thank the bloody gods.
With the air so strangely deadened, his path over the burning sand had made him feel like a piece of bacon, fried and tossed aside as inedible. The cover of night allowed him faster movement. Over the course of the next hour, he inched closer and closer to the galleon, but froze, blood draining from his cheeks, when a blade maiden wearing a turban and a red battle dress dropped down from the ship and began jogging over the sand. He'd never seen one wearing a blood-red dress before. Just looking at her made his throat go tight. He was sure she was different from the other maidens. Special, but exactly how, he wasn't certain.
Nor do I wish to find out.
The blanket hid him well. He had treated it with horse glue, then caked it in sand so that it was almost impossible to pick it out in the desert, especially from a distance. Still, this woman was a maiden. One had but to enter the desert to be regaled with stories of how they could sense enemies, even fight them in pitch darkness. He was certain she had sensed him when she cast her gaze across the horizon. But then someone called to her, another maiden, though this one wore black. The two of them continued on toward the next ship over, another stout galleon. The blood slowly returned to Brahma's cheeks.
I promise you, Baki, coins in your arms basket for a month, for a year.
Then he began moving with speed toward the galleon. As he neared the ship, something made him pause. Until now, he had felt Rumayesh's gem, as he had always felt it, a hollow space inside his chest. It had been an unerring guide since leaving Sharakai with Lord Amansir. But now he felt more. It was like the disorientation of falling in a dream, only to wake and find oneself lying safe in bed. Rumayesh was being made to perform magic, he knew. He had no idea what the queen might be doing, but he knew that it was strong, and that it had something to do with Kiral, the king of kings, who had gone below decks with Meriem moments ago. With the fires casting deep shadows on this side of the ship, Brahma slipped out from under the blanket and moved low and fast to the starboard ski. He climbed up along the ship's hull, fingers finding purchase between the planks, and came at last to a cabin window. He watched through blinds as King Kiral pulled a fine caftan over his well-muscled frame. In a chair, sitting across from Meriem, was a man with a long pepper-grey beard. His eyes were dull, his movements mechanical as he put his arms through the sleeves of a dark thorb. He seemed stricken with shock, numb to all but his thoughts. Who he was, and why these two men were getting dressed, Brahma had no idea. What magic had Meriem just performed, and on which of them? Most importantly, why had she done it? Brahma felt another twist inside his chest. Meriem drawing on the gemstone again. The man in the chair stood. Like heat lifting from the desert floor, his form began to waver, to shimmer, and then, breath of the desert, he turned transparent as glass. Brahma could see him only by his barest outline.
Oh, gods, he's heading for the window.
Brahma dropped to the sand and waited, breathless. He heard the sound of scrabbling, of scraping, and then something landed on the sand next to him. It was the man Meriem had cloaked with her magic. Brahma could see the horizon smudging, like coal on paper, as he walked eastward. As the sound of his trudging footsteps faded, the windows above were shut with a creak of poorly oiled hinges and the clatter of blinds. Kiral's deep voice resonated from inside the cabin.
Shall we begin?
Yes, but not here, came Meriem's voice. Let's retire to the desert.
Whatever they were going to do, Brahma was certain it was important. The sounds within the cabin soon softened, and then he heard them coming to deck and walking along the gangplank set on the port side of the ship. King Kiral and Queen Meriem came down to the sand where a blade maiden met them, a warden with four other maidens standing behind her ready to join the king.
We'll go alone, King Kiral said.
The warden bowed her head immediately.
As you wish, my lord king.
But Brahma noticed the shared look of confusion between the maidens standing behind her. Off they went, Meriem and Kiral walking side by side until they were lost to the darkness of the dunes. Brahma waited for a time, ensuring no one was still watching the path they had followed, then crouched and followed along their path. As he padded softly over the sand, the hollow feeling inside his chest expanded.
Brahma!
That old familiar voice, the one he had grown to despise.